Hello, this is William Fink, and this is Chris Tagetti Internet Radio. Whoops, I forgot to press the button. Today is Friday, July 8th, 2022. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and thank you for listening. This evening, I'm going to present part 17 of our commentary on the revelation of Yahshua Christ, and it is titled Of Beasts and Tyrants. And when I set out writing this program yesterday morning, I really expected to finish Revelation chapter 13 this evening, but we won't finish it. We will only get halfway through it. I didn't want to rush it, and I couldn't type 12,000 words today. I'm sorry. So we're only going to get halfway through it. The proof of our Christian faith is manifest in the fact that we can document our beliefs. And in doing so, we can also explain them clearly from ancient documents, while at the same time, we can measure them against the history of peoples and nations. And in that same study, we can also see that those beliefs cohesively explain the circumstances of our world today. But while Moses did not explain everything in the remote past, he laid a foundation for Yahshua Christ. And through him, the inspiration of Moses is also fully revealed. As Paul of Tarsus had explained in 2 Corinthians chapter 3, Moses cannot be understood without Christ. So, just as Matthew had attested, Paul must also have believed that Christ had come to reveal things kept secret from the foundation of the world. According to our interpretation, the prophecies in Revelation chapter 12 presage events in history which we associate with the aftermath of the Reformation and what we call the Age of Liberty. But they also explain events which had happened in the remote past, not only at the birth of Christ, but also at what we may refer to as the birth of Adam, even if that reference is whimsical. That's the birth of Adam in Genesis chapter 2. Through these explanations, not only may we perceive the nature of those who had been in opposition to God at the birth of Christ, but also of those who had been in opposition to Adam and to his entire race in the earliest accounts in Genesis. Revelation chapter 12 elucidates the fact that the enemies of Yahweh God are what we may call people, a race, or even ultimately races of people, who were here in this world before the creation of Adam, as they came out of the Nephilim, or fallen angels, and as they can be traced through history and the scriptures well enough to identify their descendants both in the world of the scriptures and in the world of today. These so-called people stood in opposition to God, and therefore they sought to corrupt Adam. Hence, the sinful events of Genesis chapters 3 and 6. So it is also apparent that the serpent and the Nephilim did not oppose Adam and his race through hatred or war. Rather, they opposed Adam and his race through what the world might label today as love. So with this false concept of love, love which is actually a destructive lust, Eve was seduced. Adam fell from the grace of God, and his descendants, having race mixed with the same Nephilim, were almost completely destroyed in the flood on account of their sin. Once again today, that same false concept of love prevails in the world. The same race mixing is becoming more and more prevalent, and we can anticipate judgment in the wrath of God. Later, the descendants of these same devils sought to corrupt the children of Israel. the elect heirs of Adam. In the same manner, in Numbers chapter 25, and throughout the history of the Judges period and the Old Kingdom, Satan understands the consequences of sin better than the children of God. 1,500 years later, their descendants crucified Christ, and have persecuted Christians ever since. Even later, they infiltrated the Roman Catholic Church and corrupted that. And when Christian Israel managed to free themselves of that corruption, they infiltrated the Protestant sects and kingdoms and sought to destroy them through corruption. Finally, when the first explicitly Christian nation was formed, they also sought to destroy that and worked to achieve its corruption. Now, they sit in every high office in government in this United States of America, in this new America's a portion of a new beast empire. We'll discuss that in Revelation chapter 17. Revelation chapter 12 affords us the perception to see this pattern in history very clearly. Once we understand the identity of the forces which are driving history and their intrinsic nature, which the words of Christ in that chapter, Revelation chapter 12, as well as in the Gospel, have thoroughly explained. As a digression, while academic historians use the phrase Age of Liberty in a limited sense to describe the era of parliamentary democracy in Sweden and Finland throughout the 18th century, we use the term in a much more general sense. For us, the Age of Liberty began with the Reformation and the break of many nations from tyranny, the tyranny of the Roman Catholic popes. And it continued to unfold in a process which resulted in an era of self-rule under either parliamentary democracies or republican forms of government instituted throughout Christendom. While Britain had long had parliaments, its parliament was never assured power independent of the monarchy until the Bill of Rights and the Settlement Act in 1689 and 1701 under the rule of William of Orange. But as soon as British liberty was born, the dragon would corrupt that also, as the Bank of England was founded during that same period in 1694. The current British Parliament was not founded until 1801, after the Acts of Union were approved. And I should add that it was not long until the Bank of England fell into the hands of the devil when the Rothschilds had gained control of practically everything English during the wars with Napoleon. We do not necessarily consider the term Age of Liberty in a positive light. Rather, man must realize that he cannot govern himself, and if he is not going to be governed by God, he will instead be governed by tyrants. It's inevitable. So we would equate the Age of Liberty with what the scriptures refer to as the time of Jacob's trouble, and we hope to discuss that further in our commentary on later chapters of the Revelation. The culmination of this process, which led to what we call the Age of Liberty, was at the end of the 18th century, with the birth of America and the subsequent French Revolution. But the American and French Revolutions, while they had much in common in the misunderstood or even false ideals of the Enlightenment, were in many ways polar opposites. While America was founded on a precept of Christian liberty, revolutionary France sought to completely remove God from society, and it fell immediately into the hands of a reign of terror and tyrants which were far worse than its former king. France should have been a lesson for America, which America has largely ignored. The end result was Napoleon, who had immediately set out to conquer all of Europe and let Satan loose from the pit by emancipating Europe's Jews. In turn, that event has turned the Age of Liberty into a perpetual reign of terror throughout all Christendom. And Christians are now silenced and no longer countenance sin for fear of the Jews. While we have already discussed this here to some degree, we hope to quantify the balance of our assertions as this commentary unfolds. Today we live in an age of tyranny, because many men thought that they could sustain their own liberty. But in truth, we can only have liberty in Christ, and once we depart from Him, we have an assurance that we shall indeed suffer under tyranny. It is inevitable. There is no avoiding tyranny outside of God. Today, there are idolaters who appeal to the U.S. Constitution or to the Magna Carta for the ideals or the ideals of the Enlightenment as the sustaining source of their liberty. And for their idolatry, they are enslaved in tyranny. A document which is made by men cannot defend liberty. Only God can assure liberty. And He has already told us how He would do that in the gospel of Christ. So speaking of tyranny, here in Revelation chapter 13, there is a record of a vision received by the Apostle John, which describes two great beasts, wherein the second beast comes out of a wounding of the head of the first. We shall assert that this is not a vision of post-Reformation history, and it does not take us beyond the dawn of our Age of Liberty. Rather, it is a summary view of the seven times of the punishment of the children of Israel for their sins, which once again brings us to the door of this age, which is our modern era, which began by the end of the 18th century. Therefore, as we proceed, we hope that it shall be manifest that the first beast of this chapter is the system of world empires ending with Rome, and that the second beast of this chapter is the office of the papacy and the Roman Catholic Church. This shall all be discussed here at length, and especially where it coincides with parallel prophecies found in Daniel. Before we commence with our commentary, we must briefly discuss the beginning of the chapter as it is in the King James Version, which starts with the clause, "And I stood upon the sand of the sea," as if John himself were standing on a seashore. This is primarily because the manuscripts of the majority text had the verb for stood in the first person singular. However, the 3rd century papyrus, P47, and the codices Sinaiticus, Alexandrinus, and Ephraemisiri, as well as several Greek manuscripts of the majority text from the 10th and 11th centuries, all had the third person singular form of the verb, "he stood," where the subject is the dragon, which is angered that he was ejected from heaven. So it is the dragon which stood on the sand of the sea, as that is the more authentic reading in the oldest manuscripts. The sand of the sea may represent the children of Israel, who were promised to be as the sand of the sea. And the sea itself may represent the general mass of the world's peoples. So perhaps the statement reflects the fact that the dragon would continue to rule over Israel in one way or another, and that as we come into this vision in chapter 13, that the beast rising up out of the sea also represents the dragon, whose power is behind it, as we shall also see in this chapter. And I should probably explain what the majority text is. It's not a single manuscript. The majority text is an entire collection of thousands of manuscripts, which date mostly from the 9th or 10th through the 16th centuries. And these manuscripts are all correlated and compared with one another by editors of Bible editions or Greek New Testament editions, such as the Nestle Aland Novum Testamentum Graecae that I constantly and consistently quote from or cite. So these perhaps 2,500 or so, I don't know, it's a lot, it's a very high number of manuscripts stretched over those centuries, they mostly agree with one another, but not always. Sometimes there are divergences among them, such as we've seen throughout the Revelation here, where there's a minority of those manuscripts that followed a commentary by Andreas of Caesarea and have interpolations based on his commentary. But there are other manuscripts among the majority texts that sometimes diverge in other ways. And three manuscripts here diverge from the majority text and actually follow or agree with all of these oldest manuscripts found in these codexes. So I always prefer the readings of the ancient codices, especially when they agree. They don't usually disagree, but often they do. Frequently, they do. So most of the disagreements are inconsequential to doctrine, to basically any area of doctrine. But a lot of them are consequential, and those need to be compared and examined. So that's basically an offhand explanation of the majority text. Now, with this, we shall commence with Revelation chapter 13. And I saw a beast ascending from out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads, and upon its horns 10 diadems. A word that could be interpreted as crown, and upon its heads a name of blasphemy. In our discussion of earlier portions of the Revelation, we had described the Roman Empire and the ultimate fall of Rome in correlation with Daniel chapters 2 and 7. We also correlated the falling star of Revelation chapter 8 with the Emperor Justinian and the little horn of Daniel chapter 7. Here we hope to substantiate those correlations even further. In that seventh chapter of Daniel, In that seventh chapter of Daniel, there was a vision of four great beasts which came up from the sea. And the first was a lion with eagle's wings. And the others were a bear, a leopard having four wings, and a fourth beast, which was not likened to any particular animal, but which had 10 horns. So now, as we continue with this chapter, we may imagine that this single beast is a composite of those beasts in Daniel's vision. And the similarities are so that these are two different visions representing different aspects of the same phenomenon. The seven heads are different from Daniel's one-headed beast. They seem to represent seven great world empires, rather than merely four. Or I should say, the seven heads are different than Daniel's four separate, or four one-headed beasts. The seven heads here seem to represent seven great world empires, rather than merely four. But included in these empires are traits of the beasts representing the empires in Daniel's vision, and I will explain that further. That is because the scope of John's visions in the Revelation is greater than that of Daniel's visions. The seven world empires mentioned here must be from the beginning of history, of the history of the children of Israel, all of the empires which had ever oppressed Israel, rather than starting in Daniel's time only and beginning with the king of Babylon, as we have already discussed from Daniel chapter 2, and I will elaborate on that here. So in Revelation chapter 17, we read in verse 9, "Thus is the mind having wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains, where the woman sits upon them. And there are seven kings." So the seven mountains are the seven empires. "Five have fallen. One is, and another has not yet come. And when he should come, it is necessary that he remains a short time." So the woman sits on seven mountains. And we see them as all of the world empires which would rule over the children of Israel throughout history. The five that are fallen, remember that the revelation was received by John in 96 AD. The five that are fallen are Egypt, Assyria, Media Persia, Babylon, and Greece. The one that is in John's day was Rome. The seventh empire, according to Bertrand Comparé, was the Holy Roman Empire. However, Comparé did not understand that the second beast of this chapter of the Revelation, chapter 13, is the papacy, which it was, and we will establish that here. And the Holy Roman Empire was actually only an agent of that beast, which in turn was an extension of Rome. This shall be discussed here in the second half of Revelation chapter 13, and again further on in the Revelation in our commentary for chapter 17. But Daniel, having been taken to Babylon as a youth around 605 BC, and living through the Persian conquest of 539 BC, wrote of only four of those empires which would rule over the Adamic world beginning from the time of Nebuchadnezzar's vision. Likewise, as we may also perceive in the passage from Revelation chapter 17, which we have just cited, the seven heads shall go beyond what we have seen in Daniel, and also what we shall see in this prophecy here in chapter 13. So, commencing with Revelation chapter 13, verse 2. "And the beast which I saw was like a leopard, and its feet as a bear's, and its mouth as a lion's mouth. And the dragon had given to it his power and his throne and great authority." First, we must note that this beast gets its power from the dragon. And the dragon is already described in Revelation chapter 12 as being that serpent of old, who is called the false accuser and the adversary, or the devil and Satan. At Luke chapter 4, it is recorded that a particular false accuser, or Satan, had said to Yahshua Christ, in reference to all of the kingdoms of the oikumene, or the Roman world, that, "I will give to you the authority over all this, and their honor, because to me it was delivered, and to whomever I wish I could give it. Therefore, if you would worship before me, it shall all be yours." While Revelation chapter 12 associates this satanic power with the Edomite Jew, it is evident that the same satanic Antichrist figures, which are seen today in the form of international merchants, bankers, and political figures, are very real and have been with us since the day of our creation. When Adam accepted Cain as his son, that is the reason for the sacrifices of both Abel and Cain, as Abel was competing with Cain for that position of sonship, that position of heir, the priesthood belonging to the firstborn son. So when Abel's sacrifice was accepted and Cain's rejected, Cain slew Abel, and Cain had a claim on the inheritance of Adam ever since. That is not explicit in Scripture, but it's the only circumstance which can explain this. This fact that Satan has a throne in Revelation chapter 13, and the fact that a devil could offer Christ kingship over the Roman world in Matthew or in Luke in chapter 4 of each of those Gospels. We find that story, that account, in chapter 4 of each of those Gospels. In ancient inscriptions, and this is a digression, in ancient inscriptions which were discovered at the site of the old Phoenician city of Ugarit, which stood on the coast of modern Syria, is found an apparent prayer to Baal, which read, "If thou smite Lothan, the serpent slant, destroy the serpent tortuous, Shaliot of the seven heads." It's a prayer to Baal to destroy this serpent with seven heads. That's found in ancient Near Eastern texts relating to the Old Testament on page 138. Of course, we believe that the Phoenicians were indeed the northern tribes of Israel, at least during the so-called Golden Age of Phoenicia, and also understand that they had adopted the pagan ways of their Canaanite neighbors. So perhaps the seven-headed serpent is a figure of ancient pagan mythology. Of course, the ancient Sumerians and those who followed saw a creator figure in Tiamat, a giant female serpent who is said to have created everything out of chaos. That's the pagan side of the story. That's the devil's side of the story. But the serpent was also the symbol of rulership in those same ancient societies. For example, the Egyptian pharaohs used the symbol of the asp to signify their rulership. So the serpents were fixed on the front of their crowns. The idol Marduk was originally the sun god of the Sumerian pantheon, and was later the chief god of ancient Babylon. And in inscriptions, Marduk was always accompanied by a dragon. The serpent was the symbol of kingship, not only in Egypt, but also in Sumer, Akkad, and among the Hittites. And when I say Akkad, I mean the Assyrians, Akkad being their capital city. And that's found on inscriptions recorded in ancient Near Eastern texts relating to the Old Testament on pages 263 and 276 and elsewhere. I only cite those as examples. In Daniel chapter 2, the prophet described and explained a vision, which Nebuchadnezzar II, the king of Babylon, had experienced. Nebuchadnezzar ascending to the throne in perhaps 606 BC. He experienced this vision, and by it he had been quite disturbed. So Daniel explained that the vision represented four great kingdoms, his own, and three others which would arise in succession after him. These are the kingdoms of the Persians, Greeks, and Romans, which we have discussed at length in relation to the assurance of God in our introduction to Revelation chapter 7. So there it is seen that this beast, of which Nebuchadnezzar is only the head, is a series of four great kingdoms which in turn rule over the oikoumene, or that part of the world civilized by the Adamic man. But now we must observe some differences between this chapter 13 beast and the beast in Nebuchadnezzar's vision. Nebuchadnezzar's beast did not have seven heads with crowns, or 10 horns, as there are with this beast here in Revelation chapter 13. Neither is Nebuchadnezzar's beast described as having a duration of 1,260 years, or 3.5 times, which is the 42 months of verse 5 here in Revelation chapter 13. That is because, as we have already explained, Nebuchadnezzar's vision only concerned his present and the future. So the description of the beast in Daniel chapter 2 is only a partial view of the interpretation of this first beast in Revelation chapter 13. And it is not its entirety. So in that chapter, Daniel's four kingdoms had a duration of only about 1,080 years, from 606 BC with the ascension of Nebuchadnezzar to the throne. I'm sorry, perhaps I should have written 1,070 years. I'm not an accountant. From 606 BC with the ascension of Nebuchadnezzar to the throne to 476 AD and the fall of Rome. It is a parallel prophecy, but does not correspond in its entirety. What it does help us to understand, however, is that in the people who destroyed Nebuchadnezzar's beast, those who invaded and destroyed the Roman Empire, the true people of God are identified. The Roman Church asserts the claim that it had supplanted Daniel's fourth kingdom, and therefore it represents the kingdom of God. That is an absolutely false claim. In actuality, the Roman Church followed this beast, as Revelation chapter 13, verses 11 through 18 describe, but it did not supplant it. With all certainty, the book of Nebuchadnezzar's beast, the succession of empires ending with Rome, was destroyed by both its own corruption, the iron which did not mix with the clay, and by the Germanic children of dispersed Israel, which invaded and for a time supplanted it, and who are destined to supplant it, but not by the Roman Church. The Roman Church was a product of the empire, organized by the Emperor Constantine and not by the apostles of Christ. So with that statement, before we return to Revelation chapter 13 and attempt to interpret the vision of this first beast, the first part of Daniel chapter 7, which is also a parallel prophecy, shall be read and rather briefly discussed. It's actually a little more than brief, but comparatively, it'll be briefly discussed. Daniel chapter 7, verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed. Then he wrote a dream and told the sum of the matters. Daniel spoke and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heaven strove upon the great sea, and four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another. These beasts, Daniel described here, come out of the sea, the mass of the world's peoples, but not necessarily Israelites. just as this beast in Revelation chapter 13 emerges from the sea. An examination of these beasts reveals them to be those same world empires described by Daniel in chapter 2 of his prophecy. Daniel chapter 7 verse 4. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth and made stand upon the feet as a man. And a man's heart was given to it. And this describes ancient Babylon. The last line may refer to the rise of the Chaldean rule in Babylon. The city was said to have been built by the Amorites under their famous king Hammurabi, who were Canaanites, while the Chaldeans were evidently Syrians, of the ancient tribe of Aram, and possibly also of Arphaxad, all of them cousins to the Hebrews. Daniel chapter 7 verse 5. And behold, another beast, a second, like to a bear, and it raised itself up on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it, between the teeth of it. And they said thus unto it, Arise, devour much flesh. And the bear is the empire of the Medes and the Persians, which conquered the seats of three former world empires, the three ribs representing Egypt, Assyria, and Babylon. Daniel chapter 7 verse 6. After this I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. And the leopard is very fast. This describes Alexander's Hellenistic Empire, which conquered the Old World very quickly. I believe it was not much more than 10 years. The four wings are the four pieces into which it was dissolved soon after Alexander's death. And I should say the four heads and four wings. Verse 7. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces, and stamped the residue with the feet of it. And it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. As it was in Daniel chapter 2, the Roman Empire is described as the most horrible of all beasts. Rome also conquered much of the territory held by all of the empires which preceded it, with the exclusion of Parthia, which consisted of the eastern parts of the former Persian Empire. Verse 8, Daniel chapter 7. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were the eyes, like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. A lot of commentators strive to imagine that the 10 horns are the Germanic kingdoms which the Western Empire had been divided into after its fall. This is inaccurate, because in Daniel's description it is evident that the fourth beast had the 10 horns, not those who destroyed it. It possessed them before it was divided. The horns may be interpreted to have two different descriptions, and therefore there are two different interpretations, both of which may certainly be valid. Here is the first, and the second shall be discussed below when we discuss verse 20 of this chapter, where it states that the 10 horns are 10 kings. Here, the 10 horns seem to also represent the original 10 senatorial provinces of the Roman Empire, which would indeed be the 10 toes of the beast described in Daniel chapter 2. The little horn which arises out of them represents the Byzantine Empire, and especially Justinian, as shall be made even more evident later in this chapter. In 14 AD, the Roman Empire was divided into provinces, both senatorial and imperial. The senatorial provinces belonged to the people of Rome, and their governors were chosen by the Senate. There were 10 in number: Achaia, Africa, Asia, Crete, and Cyrene, Cyprus, Gallia Narbonensis, which was the Mediterranean coastal province of what is now France, Hispania Baetica in southern Spain, Macedonia and Thessaly, Pontus and Bithynia, and Sicily. And I know it sounded like more than 10, but it's only 10 provinces. Crete and Cyrene are one province, and Pontus and Bithynia were one province, and Macedonia, Thessaly was incorporated into the province of Macedonia. According to the 6th century historian Procopius, Justinian was from the tribe of the Dardanians in what would have been the Roman province of Macedonia. All of the other Roman provinces, 21 at this time, and I won't name them all, were imperial provinces, the fruits of conquest for which the emperor chose the governors. There were many more imperial provinces added after the first century, but there were still the same 10 senatorial provinces. Italy was not a province. Italy was governed by the people directly. The Little Horn came up out of these 10 senatorial provinces, and as shall be evident below, or actually in our later presentation, in our presentation on the later half of Revelation chapter 13. That little horn had eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking great things. The Byzantines under Justinian had reconquered 3 portions of the old Western Empire, which had been taken by the Germanic invaders: Italy itself, Africa, and southern Spain, clearly identifying Byzantium with this little horn. Moving on to Daniel chapter 7, verse 9. I beheld, till the thrones were cast down, and the Ancient of Days did sit, whose garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head was like the pure wool. His throne was like the fiery flame, and his wheels as burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. Thousand thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The judgment was set, and the books were opened. The description of the throne of the Ancient of Days in Daniel is very much like the descriptions of the throne of Yahweh as it is depicted by Yahshua Christ here in the Revelation. Here Daniel saw a vision of the Day of Judgment, but he was only able to prophesy in detail what would transpire up to the point where these thrones which he described had been cast down. And that may seem to be only as far as the fall of Rome. But as we shall see, the 11th horn being identified with Justinian, it actually extends as far as the rule of the Roman Catholic Church under the popes, which is described here in Revelation chapter 13 as a product and an extension of the old Roman Empire. Daniel chapter 11. Daniel chapter 7, verse 11. I beheld then, because of the voice of the great words which the horn spoke, I beheld even till the beast was slain, and his body destroyed, and given to the burning flame. Since the beast is a symbol of world domination, a system of world domination, and not an individual, the body and the flame are allegorical. Even the individual Justinian was only a part of the system, although he is a significant figure here because of the accomplishments which the beast had made during his rule, which are the same events described later in Daniel chapter 7. These accomplishments allowed for the rise of the second beast of Revelation chapter 13, which we shall discuss at length later in this chapter. Furthermore, an interpretation of the nature of the lake of fire mentioned in Revelation chapters 19 and 20 must also be made within this context. It is a destructive force that incinerates all of the enemies of God, and not, as many false teachers profess, a cleansing force that purifies those who are thrown into it, as Wesley Swift had at one time asserted. And I have a link to the paper where he asserted that in the notes here. It's titled The Sermon. It's titled Shekinah Glory. The lake of fire only purifies in the sense that it eliminates all of those who are, allegorically, thrown into it, as it is seen here. The body of the beast is slain and destroyed and given to the burning flame. And this is the same beast in Revelation chapter 19, which is thrown into the lake of fire. All of the goat nations also have their destiny in that same lake of fire, prepared for the devil and his angels, as we read in Matthew chapter 25 in verse 41. Moving on to Daniel chapter 7 verse 12. As concerning the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. This is where the children of Yahweh are today. On paper, the people of Christian Israel are in a period of self-rule, possessing the kingdom of Yahweh for themselves ever since the Reformation, and especially since the monarchies of Europe were for the most part replaced by modern parliamentary democracies. However, in reality, they are still under the control and influence of these same beasts which have exercised power in Europe for nearly three millennia. Daniel chapter 7 verse 13. I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man. The original only has a Son of Man. There is no article in the Hebrew or in the Greek versions. One like a Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven and came to the Ancient of Days. And they brought him near before him. And there was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed. As it is in Daniel chapter 9, this is also a messianic prophecy. Yahshua Christ is God incarnate as one of his own Adamic people, a son of Adam and Israel. And he is also Yahweh himself in the flesh, so Paul calls him the firstborn among many brethren, Romans chapter 8 verse 29, which he certainly is. The people of all of the Adamic nations, languages, and tongues shall serve Yahshua Christ himself at his manifestation. Of course, just as all of the promises of the entire Bible are limited to the nations of the race of Adam, right from the beginning, Genesis chapter 3 verse 22, Genesis chapter 5 verses 1 and 2, so it is here because God does not change. And with that, we will conclude Daniel chapter 7, our discussion of it this evening, with verses 15 through 18. I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit, in the midst of my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. I came near unto one of them that stood by, and asked him the truth of all this. So he told me, and made me know the interpretation of the things. These great beasts, which are four kings which shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. Here Daniel's vision is interpreted. It is evident that the first part of the account of these beasts describes four kingdoms that shall rule over the oikumene, or as Nebuchadnezzar was told by Daniel, wheresoever the children of men dwell. This, it shall also be evident, is describing those same entities which are seen with the first beast of Revelation chapter 13, verses 1 through 7. It's describing them in part. Yet the saints, or holy ones, of Yahweh God are promised that they would inherit the earth, and God shall indeed keep that promise. This discussion shall return to the later part of Daniel chapter 7 and the balance of his interpretation when we come to the second beast of Revelation chapter 13. For now, we shall continue with the first half of the chapter, continuing the vision of the first beast, a single beast having seven heads and ten horns. So we move on to Revelation chapter 13, verse 3. And one from among its heads, as if having been slaughtered unto death, yet the wound of its death had been healed. And the whole earth marveled after the beast, and they worshipped the dragon, because he had given authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, Who is like the beast, and who is able to make war with it? This beast, having seven heads, represents seven world empires which have ruled over the children of Israel throughout their history. And therefore, it is a composite which encompasses and includes the diverse beasts in the visions of Daniel. But this is also, obviously, one and the same with the beast of Revelation chapter 12, verse 3, which is the great red dragon that is also associated with that old serpent, the devil, and Satan. As it is the dragon, which also has the seven heads and the ten horns. Furthermore, verses 12 and 14 of this chapter associate the second beast of John's vision to this first beast, to be the healing of the wounded head. So the second beast of Revelation chapter 13 is not really a head of its own, and does not count among the seven. Rather, it is an extension which grew out of one of the seven heads, and therefore it is of the same nature or character as that head. Today, we ourselves marvel and ask, Who is able to make war with the beast? But the answer is that we must trust in God. We must trust in Yahweh our God, because he shall make war with the beast, and he shall prevail. The beast governments of history have always appeared to be all-powerful in the eyes of men. The Romans mercilessly crushed all rebellion, and the legions seemed invincible. But like every empire, Rome could not stand on feet of iron mixed with clay. And so it is also today that the American Empire, that eventually it too shall break apart and become vulnerable. To a great extent, the Germanic tribes were held in abeyance on the frontiers of the Roman Empire for several centuries, while Rome was a monolithic power, although they coveted the lands that the Romans had held. But once the empire began to fracture, as the iron and clay were not cohesive, they had an opportunity to accelerate its fall and to divide it amongst themselves. Today we await a similar opportunity and the call to arise and thresh, but not until the fall of Mystery Babylon. Only then shall the time of Jacob's trouble pass. So Christians have an obligation that they cannot avoid. They cannot shirk this obligation and be victorious. They cannot shirk this obligation and expect their God to help them, as Paul had explained in 2 Corinthians chapter 10. They must bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ, and having in a readiness to revenge all disobedience when your obedience is fulfilled. The most significant words there are when your obedience is fulfilled. Yahweh God is not going to bring a disobedient people to victory. It's not going to happen. The children of Israel must repent, as they did in the Old Testament. That's our model. There's no getting around it. Another way to understand what these visions describe is to look back at history and see who it was that defiled and blasphemed the temple of Yahweh. The Babylonians, as scripture tells us, also that the Edomites were allied with them, had destroyed the first temple of Yahweh. Babylon was the gold head of the beast of the vision in Daniel chapter 2, and the lion with the eagle's wings in Daniel chapter 7. Then around 160 BC, the Greek rulers of Syria, a part of the trunk of brass of the beast in Daniel chapter 2, and of the leopard with the four wings and four heads of Daniel chapter 7, had defiled the second temple. Finally, the Romans, the two legs of Nebuchadnezzar's beast, sought to set up their own idols in the temple of Yahweh, the last one which was actually built in the reign of Herod the Edomite. And therefore, all of the blasphemy and defilement of the temple of God by this ongoing system of world empires, which this first beast of Revelation chapter 13 also describes, is fully evident. Here it is seen that this first beast had authority to act for 42 months, or 1260 prophetic years, from the time when the children of Israel were deported by the Assyrians, which began approximately 741 BC, unto the fall of Rome in 476 AD. That period was 1218 years. Yet Assyria rose as an empire from the time of Adad-nirari III, who ruled from 810 BC to 783 BC. This Assyrian king's mother was the Babylonian princess Sammu-Rammat, who was the source of the later Semiramis myths of the Greeks. Adad-nirari III first invaded ancient Israel, reaching Palestine in 804 BC. While they are not recorded in the biblical records, Adad-nirari's marches into Palestine and his collection of tribute from Israel in the days of Jehoash and Jeroboam II are mentioned in Assyrian inscriptions. From 804 BC to 476 AD, and the final fall of Rome is about 1280 years, the reckoning of men. Note that John dates the first beast, but not the second. It shall become evident below that Daniel dates the second beast, which is described here by John. The number of 1260 years cannot include Egypt, or the last of John's seven kings, which is not yet come. Yet the beast nevertheless had seven heads, and those two kingdoms are a part of this beast, while their authority is evidently outside of this period. That is evident because, as we have already explained, this period of the two beasts describes the period of Israel's punishment for her sins, which the Old Testament kingdom was destroyed, and she was sent off into captivity. The seven times prophecy is found on four occasions among the curses for disobedience in Leviticus chapter 26, where the word of Yahweh says on one of those occasions, from verse 27, "And if you will not for all this hearken unto me, but walk contrary unto me, then I will walk contrary unto you also in fury. And I, even I, will chastise you seven times for your sins." If a day in prophecy is a year, which we shall discuss in detail later in this chapter, then seven times 360 is 2,520 years. Double the period of 42 months, or 1,260 years, which is given to this beast. That seven times of punishment also explains, and is explained by, the authority given to this beast, which is now described here in Revelation chapter 13, verse 7. "And there had been given to it to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority had been given to it over every tribe and people and tongue and nation." The 3rd century papyrus, P47, and the codices Alexandrinus and Ephraemiseri, and the majority text manuscripts following Andreas of Caesarea, all want the first clause in this verse, where it says, "And there had been given to it to make war with the saints and to overcome them," which I was tempted to omit, but include here hesitantly. The Codex Sinaiticus and the traditional manuscripts of the majority text and certain early Latin, Coptic, and Syriac manuscripts contain the clause, for which we may compare Daniel chapter 7, verses 8, 21, and 25. So I decided to include the clause. As Daniel said in his vision in Daniel chapter 2, "From the time of Nebuchadnezzar, the beast system of world empires would rule wheresoever the children of men dwell." And so it is here. These words being understood to be exclusive to the white Adamic race in general. So within both the historical and the prophetic context of these words, every tribe and people and tongue and nation can only be interpreted to include wheresoever the children of men dwell, which are the tribes and peoples and tongues and nations which had been ruled over by this series of empires, the Babylonian, Persian, Greek, and Roman. All of the races outside of this so-called world are not a part of this world and have no part or consideration within the context of any of these biblical promises or prophecies. None. They don't belong in this picture. Moving on to verse 8. "And all those dwelling upon the earth worshipped it, of whom their names are not written in the book of the life of the Lamb, who have been slaughtered from the foundation of society." As a digression, critics of the Codex Sinaiticus often point out its supposed errors and favor the Codex Alexandrinus version of the revelation. Sometimes I do, and sometimes I do not. Here, the Codex Alexandrinus has a serious error where it says, "of whom their names," and it reads, "woe, his name," which is nonsense. The Codex Ephraemiseri has an error, "of whom his name." The majority text has, "of whom the name." Our text, "of whom their names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb," follows the Codex Sinaiticus and the 3rd century papyrus P47. Quite frequently, where the Codex Sinaiticus and the Codex Alexandrinus differ. The Sinaiticus agrees with the 3rd century papyrus P47, which is by far the oldest surviving text of the Revelation. However, in the error which I had mentioned, or in the wanting of the first clause of verse 7, the Codex Alexandrinus agrees with the papyrus P47 and not the Codex Sinaiticus. So quite frequently, but not always, is there agreement with either the Sinaiticus or the Alexandrinus and P47. And papyrus P47 is by far the oldest surviving text of the Revelation, although it is fragmented, and only portions of chapters 9 through 17 have survived. So the critics of the Codex Sinaiticus are not fair in their assessment. Those who worship the beast are those whose names are not written in the book of life. The children of Yahweh should not have a care for the beast, but rather they should long for the return of Yahshua Christ and their final restoration into his kingdom, ruining the day when their ancestors had first sought an earthly king. That the Lamb was slaughtered from the foundation of society, or the world in most Bible translations, is evidence that all history is predetermined by Yahweh himself, and he knew even before the creation of Adam what he would have to do in order to chastise and to instruct his children. The first promise of restoration is at Genesis chapter 3, verse 22, which says in part, "Behold, the man is become as one of us, to know good and evil. And now, lest he put forth his hand, and take also of the tree of life, and eat, and live forever." Yahshua Christ being that tree of life, he knew long before then that he would have to make his ultimate sacrifice for our benefit. Like him, Christians should fear Yahweh God, and not those who can kill the body only, but then have no further power. There is indeed life apart from the flesh. So Yahshua Christ, who described himself as the true vine in John chapter 15, is described here as the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world, as the King James Version translates the clause. This is a statement of the prescience of Yahweh, who knew, before the society was created, that he would have to redeem his people from their sins. And therefore he must have planned from the beginning to come as a man in order to also be an example to his people. Paul of Tarsus had explained that same thing, where we read in Hebrews chapter 2, "Therefore, since the children have taken part in flesh and blood, he also in like manner took part in the same, that through death he would annul him having the power of death, that is, the false accuser, or the devil, and he would release them, as many as whom in fear of death, throughout all their lives, were subject as slaves. For surely not that of messengers or angels has he taken upon himself," conscious decision to come as a man, a conscious decision. He must be Yahweh God to make that conscious decision, premeditated decision to come as a man, the Lamb slain from the beginning of the world, from the foundation of the world. "For surely, not that of messengers has he taken upon himself, but he has taken upon himself of the offspring of Abraham, from which he was obliged in all respects to become like the brethren, that he would be a compassionate and faithful high priest of the things pertaining to Yahweh, to make a propitiation for the failures of the people." And the proof that he came as an example to men is in the very next verse. "In what he himself has suffered being tested, He is able to help those being tested. Christ came and acted as a man, not as a God, to be an example to men. But of course, the prescience of God also foresees and governs the fate of men, which is now also made evident in verse 9 of Revelation chapter 13. If one has an ear, he must hear. If one is for captivity, into captivity he goes. If one is to be slain by the sword, he is to be slain by the sword. Thus is the patience and the faith of the saints. The word for the phrase, the word for in the phrase for captivity, is in a sense of being destined for captivity. The 3rd century papyrus, P47. The Codices Sinaiticus and Ephraemiseri and the majority texts all want the phrase into captivity, which would not change the meaning of the clause. It would merely say, if one is for captivity, he goes. So the meaning would be the same. The text follows the Codex Alexandrinus, our text. The Codex Sinaiticus has the second clause of the verse to read. If one slays by the sword, it is necessary for him to be slain by the sword. Where the Codex Ephraemiseri and the majority text manuscripts following Andreas of Caesarea differ only in the tense of one verb, if one shall slay by the sword. However, all of these readings offend the overall context of the passage. The traditional majority text manuscripts have, if one by the sword, I'm sorry, I just wanted to try to double check something real quick, but my eyes are just failing me, and I think I need a magnifying glass, so I apologize for that. If one slays by the sword, it is necessary for him to, I'm sorry. Our text follows the Codex Alexandrinus. The Codex Sinaiticus has the second clause of the verse to read. Our text to the first clause follows the Codex Alexandrinus. I'm really botching this. The Codex Sinaiticus has the second clause of the verse to read, if one slays by the sword, it is necessary for him to be slain by the sword. But the Codex Ephraemiseri and the majority text manuscripts following Andreas of Caesarea have, if one shall slay by the sword. But all of these readings, as I will explain, offend the overall context of the passage. And finally, the traditional majority text manuscripts have, if one by the sword is slain, it is necessary for him to be slain. So the traditional majority text manuscripts share the sense of the reading in the Codex Alexandrinus. In a single Greek manuscript of the majority text, just one of those 2,500 and something manuscripts, or whatever the number is, it might be more than that, which is identified in the Nestle Aland Novum Testamentum Graecae with the number 2351. There is a verb which may be rendered as he that leadeth, where the King James Version has the first sentence of verse 10 to read, he that leadeth into captivity shall go into captivity. He that killeth with the sword must be killed by the sword. The word translated as he that killeth is found in a majority text manuscripts following Andreas of Caesarea, which we have already explained, and which the King James Version frequently followed elsewhere. The New American Standard Bible correctly interprets the first clause in verse 10, where it reads, if anyone is destined for captivity, to captivity he goes, adding the word destined in italics, But as I explained, that is what the preposition infers. If one is for captivity, into captivity he goes. But then the New American Standard Bible accepts an interpolation where it has the second clause to read, if anyone kills with the sword he must be killed. The additional verbs, which do not belong in the text, and which appear in the King James Version as he that leadeth and he that killeth, completely change the meaning of the passage. This passage is not teaching karma, or like punishment for the things which one has done in one's life. Although in Galatians chapter 6, Paul had written that for whatsoever a man soweth, that he shall also reap. Although Christ had warned Peter not to bear the sword, lest he be killed by the sword. Those words were written or uttered in a completely different context. Rather, we would reject the additional verbs as interpolations and prefer to believe that here the revelation is teaching the prescience of God in the lives of men, as in this context, the children of Israel are being punished for their sins. So this verse teaches predestination and not judgment. Just as Joshua knew his own fate from the beginning, he also knows the fate of each of his children. While man has free will, a choice to make his own errors or to seek good, Yahweh being God cannot help knowing ahead of time what route each man shall take. So even our concept and perception of free will is an illusion in the eyes of God. So in other words, this does not say, he that leads into captivity shall go into captivity, and he that kills with the sword must be killed by the sword. What this verse says is, if one is for captivity, or destined for captivity, into captivity he goes, and if one is to be slain by the sword, he is to be slain by the sword. Here Yahshua Christ is affirming the punishment of Israel, which was forewarned in Leviticus and pronounced in the prophets. But in relation to this passage, especially in Jeremiah chapter 15, where we read, where it is spoken of the children of Israel, then said Yahweh unto me, though Moses and Samuel stood before me, yet my mind could not be toward this people. Cast them out of my sight, and let them go forth. And it shall come to pass, if they say unto thee, whither shall we go forth? Then thou shalt tell them, thus saith Yahweh, such as are for death to death, and such as are for the sword to the sword, and such as are for the famine to the famine, and such as are for the captivity to the captivity. Several late manuscripts of the so-called church fathers in Latin and Syriac also added verbs to this clause, perverting its meaning. Yet the Greek text of Jeremiah chapter 15 verse 2 is very much like what we read here in the Revelation, and therefore this passage fully supports the veracity of our reading and interpretation of this verse. So we read in a prayer of Ezra in chapter 9, and I said, O my God, I am ashamed and blush to lift up my face to thee, my God. For our iniquities are increased over our head, and our trespass is grown up into the heavens. Since the days of our fathers have we been in a great trespass unto this day, and for our iniquities have we, our kings and our priests, been delivered into the hand of the kings of the lands, to the sword, to captivity, and to a spoil, and to confusion of face, as it is this day. He who is destined to be a race mixer shall be a race mixer, I gather. Here we shall pause our commentary of Revelation chapter 13, and Yahweh willing, bring it to a conclusion next week, where we hope to discuss the second beast described in this chapter. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and thank you for listening. Good night.